Case number 12-7106, Cohen Telschick, Appellant v. Williams & Jensen, PLLC, et al. Mr. Brock for the Appellant, Mr. May for the Appellee.
Good
morning. Mr. Brown, I look to see where you're from in Texas, Houston, and I know they probably have traffic problems there too, but not like Washington's apparently.
Apparently there was just enough snow, Your Honor, to cause people to forget how to drive. And what normally is a 30-35 minute drive wound up taking over an hour and a half. So I apologize to the court, and I appreciate the court's indulging the effects of the traffic upon me.
All right.
If I may proceed.
Yes.
Good morning. I am Butch Brott. I have the honor of representing Corwin Telschick, the appellant. And this case can be boiled down to, I believe, three issues. One is, if an attorney enters an unauthorized appearance for a defendant and confesses judgment, are they liable for all damages? Every case that I have found has ever addressed that issue says yes. There are some, and we cited one in the footnote, that says the judgment is void as to the defendant. But the problem with that is the FEC has no provision, no way to set aside a conciliation agreement. This is different than a proceeding in district court. Interestingly, if you go and look at the bound volumes, in Federal Digest, there is the 17 case that we cite from the Circuit of New Jersey. And then in the American Centennial Digest, there are a number of cases all standing for the same proposition. The last one is in 1883. Lawyers apparently learned you don't do that. The next case that addresses it is not until 1949, and it holds the same way. There is a, under attorney and client in the West Digest system, there is a key number for unauthorized appearance. So when Meredith Kelly signed that conciliation agreement, she did so without Mr. Telschick's authority. That's undisputed. And under the case law as it exists, she is liable for all damages that flow from that, which would include damages to reputation. The second issue that has to, in connection with that, who can bind the respondents before the FEC? There's only two people. One is the respondent. The respondent can bind him or herself and the PAC or an attorney. Mr. Telschick wasn't there. That judgment is entitled to be recognized. The only way it can be is if she was acting as an attorney. The second issue I believe that needs to be addressed is the judicial privilege. And the question here is, does an attorney have a right to libel somebody who stands in the position of a client? If I, as an attorney, sign a judgment against someone, and in that judgment I have libeled them, do they have a cause of action against me? More so, you know, let's eliminate this question where it's an unauthorized appearance. If I, as an attorney, represent John Doe, and I file documents that slander or libel my client, can I raise the judicial privilege as a shield? The answer to that should be no. And then the third issue that has to be addressed is, will damages to reputation lie in extraordinary negligence cases? And I believe the authorities that we have given the court show yes. It is not only in defamation. There is a cause of action for defamation, but defamation damages are a type of damage that can rise from extraordinary negligence. And I believe that this case is one of extraordinary negligence, and we should have been allowed to proceed on
the case. Now, did you find any D.C. law on this, any district law on that issue?
Specifically? No. I'm relying upon the cases that Judge Kennedy cited in the, and Judge, is it Rothstein? The judge who dismissed the case, they both cited Jorgensen, which is a Massachusetts case, for the proposition that we couldn't recover defamation damages. So they were both looking outside the district on that issue. So I don't think it's a question of creating new law. It's, this is the law. The law is assumed to be universal, with the exception of Louisiana, which is, I don't have enough time to discuss that. But the, it would be anomalous to think that when D.C. has held that fraud, the breach of fiduciary duty is a fraud upon the principal, and fraud will support punitive damages, and that, you know, if we go back to the question of the attorney being liable for all damages, that has to include reputation damage. I'm going to reserve the my rest of the time. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer this time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. May?
May it please the court, my name is John May. I'm representing the defendants appellees Williams & Jensen PLLC, Williams & Jensen PC, Barbara Whitson Bonfiglio, and Meredith Kelly, now Lesher. I want to jump to the reputation issue, which Mr. Brock addressed last. The trial court correctly ruled that Mr. Telchik could not recover damages for an alleged injury to his reputation when he was already barred from recovering those same damages in a defamation action. The essential holding here is that if the negligence is the result of the publication of the defamatory material, your sole cause of action is for defamation. And if you are barred from bringing that defamation claim, you cannot repackage it as a negligence claim or a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
Is there a case that says if the communication is privileged, you still can't bring anything but a defamation?
No, I didn't see a case that limits it that far down to whether or not there's a privilege. The only question is whether or not you can bring a claim other than a defamation claim. And here, he brought his defamation claim, and it was barred.
In other words, if you can't bring a
defamation claim, then there's nothing to bring.
Well, and that's a little different from saying if you can bring a defamation claim, then you can't bring a negligence action.
Well, put the cart before the horse. If you brought the negligence claim, the court would say, no, you can't bring this as a negligence claim. You have to bring it as a defamation claim. So you bring your defamation claim. The court says, you can't bring a defamation claim. It's privileged. The fact that you reverse the order and you bring the defamation claim as count one and the negligence claim as count two, and the court rules. I mean, the court could have addressed this all in one motion for summary judgment, but it wasn't argued. The second argument wasn't argued in the motion for summary judgment. It was argued in the jury instruction. But they all come at the same time. If you have a defamation claim, it's got to be a defamation claim. If you are claiming that someone damaged you as a result of publishing something that was false, that's a defamation claim. And the interesting conundrum here is that Mr. Telchik cannot sue for defamation because of the privilege, even if there was an intentional defamation here. And yet, he's trying to sue on the grounds that there was a negligent defamation by calling it not defamation but negligence. It's important to understand that the only damages he was asking for at trial were general reputational damages. He had specifically said, I'm not going to try to prove any lost profits. I'm not going to try to prove any kind of compensatory damages. So we're not talking about the kinds of damages you normally obtain in a negligence case. We're talking about the kinds of damages that you get that are unique to defamation cases, where injury to the reputation is presumed, and yet it's not really quantified. I mean, how does the jury determine general damages to reputation? That's, in fact, in the Ross versus Gallant case, they made a comment that defamation is the gist of the claim. Common law negligence is not an alternative basis for recovery. This is not necessarily a result of logic. It is a product of the historical development of the law of defamation. It's a unique tort. And as a result, the damages that you can get under that tort are not the same kinds of damages you can get for other torts. The general tort law...
So is there no remedy then for a client in this kind of situation where the attorney allegedly defames the client?
Depends what you mean by remedy, Your Honor. When we talk about, when we get to the issue of privilege, the court in, I think the Arneja case, talked about the public policy reason for the privilege, and it said, look, there are two policies here. One is to allow freedom of expression, and the other is a separate public policy is the integrity and civility of legal proceedings as preserved by the public. A potential alternative mechanism available to deal with outrageous conduct by an attorney in lieu of an action for damages may be the policing function of the Bar Disciplinary Committee. I don't know that that's a remedy, but the point is that, yes, if you are barred from bringing this kind of claim, yes, it deters. But if you are barred from bringing this kind of claim, you are barred, and there is no remedy. If he had said, look, this ruined my business. Here's how much money I was making the year before. Here's how much money I was making the year after. Here are clients to testify. They didn't hire me after reading this conciliation agreement. Here's an economist to say how much money I've lost. He can get those damages. But he can't just walk into the courtroom and say, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, I've been damaged. My reputation is be harmed. I can't tell you how much. In fact, he disclaimed knowing how much. But you as the jury can decide that because this is a defamation case. Okay, you can do that in a defamation case. You cannot do it in a negligence case. Let me jump over to the question of privilege.
So it's both a change of theory and a lack of proof?
Correct. Well, the change of theory comes because of the lack of proof. If you cannot prove that you have a debt, well, what happened was his defamation claim was barred because of the privilege. Therefore, he said, okay, well, then we'll argue our same damages under negligence. In the discovery responses, he had claimed that he had compensatory damages, that he'd lost clients. Mm-hmm. But I filed a motion in limine on that subject, and when it came to argue it, Mr. Telchik's counsel said, no, we're not going to claim those kinds of damages, which left us with only general reputation damages, which made it then clear that that was not the kind of damages that can be pursued in the negligence claim. But let's talk about the privilege. Judge Kennedy dismissed the defamation-based claims on the grounds that they all arose out of the publication of the conciliation agreement, which is the only claim that really exists in this case. Mr. Telchik's attempt to now bring other wrongful acts into the case to try to prove something else are really irrelevant. And, in fact, Judge Kennedy threw them out when Mr. Telchik tried to support his opposition to the motion for summary judgment with them and tried to amend his complaint. In any event, now Mr. Telchik is arguing, well, there was another element to this defense that he did not argue below. And that's an adversity element. And he doesn't cite a case from the District of Columbia that says the three elements for the judicial privilege are making a statement in the course of or preliminary to a judicial proceeding related in some way to the underlying proceeding against a person who's an adversary. That third element doesn't exist in any case that you'll look at. What he did was he found some dicta, some statement from the Finkelstein case that talks about the need to attorneys to be free, to be not have to worry about claims without fear of a retaliatory harassment from their adversaries. But Finkelstein doesn't rely on that proposition. That's not an essential point to that case. It happened to be an adversary, but they didn't say that that's something you had to prove. And when Finkelstein made that comment, it cited the Arneja case. And I think also the restatement. Now, the restatement, when you look at it, says nothing about an adversary. It says an attorney is absolutely privileged to publish defamatory matter concerning another, doesn't say who, as part of a judicial proceeding in which he participates as counsel. Arneja recognized, as I said before, two public policies, one allowing counsel to zealously represent a client without fear of reprisal, and second, a separate public policy concern of integrity and civility of legal proceedings. We searched and searched and searched, and we found two cases where the court seemed to allow the imposition of the privilege, even though the person being defamed was the client. One is in the Weiler case, and the one is in the Borden versus Clement case, which was a particularly clear case because the lawyer, in the middle of a hearing, jumped up and said of his lone client, this is a criminal conspiracy. And the client sued him for defamation, and the court threw it out because it was privileged. It seems to me that what Mr. Telchik is trying to do here is to change the law. He's trying to add an element to the privilege. Number three, the one that we haven't seen in any of the cases. And frankly, that's not allowed in federal court. It's the D.C. courts that are required to change substantive law. As the court says, we take the law of the appropriate jurisdiction as we find it and leave it undisturbed. That's, I believe, from the Tidler case. And frankly, it wouldn't even be appropriate to certify this question because this isn't a question. This is not a case where the issue is unsettled. It's very clear. The only other issue I want to address quickly in my last 15 seconds is this issue of to whom did the attorneys owe a duty? It's clear to me they owe the duty to the office, not to the person. And it's just like a case of an attorney in government representing the office of the president or the secretary of state, something like that.
We don't need to address that issue if we agree with you on the others.
That's correct.
But since you brought it up, did you find in any of these cases when the failed defamation claim or the defamation claim that can't be brought in any way hinges on the capacity of the, in other words, he was defamed only in his, if he was, only in his official capacity, and that you were talking about that just at the end, about the duty of the lawyer to the treasurer in his official capacity,
right,
not personally.
Right. Well, no. It raises an interesting question. Could he be defamed at all when he was only being defamed as an office of a corporation rather than as a person? I mean, his position is that's my name. People read my name. They associate me with these wrongful acts. But the reality of this situation is that even the government makes it very clear when these MURs are brought, if we name you in your official capacity, and they publish this in the Federal Register in their statement of policy, if we name you in your official capacity, we're not naming you, we're naming your office, and you can substitute somebody else. Well, I'm obviously out of time. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to address them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Brett have left?
If it pleases the court, I'd first like to address the DAPCO case, the Borden case the counsel brought up. Mr. Clement was the attorney for the gentleman who was libeled, but in other cases, in the case where he uttered the defamatory statement, he represented DAPCO. That is clearly not the point. That is the purpose of the privilege. In this case, I represent DAPCO. I don't represent Mr. Borden. I may represent him over there. Not in this case. In this case, he's my adversary. That is not on point. As to the office versus the individual, the Committee of 100 Democrats makes it very clear. Who gets hauled into court? The individual person. Ken Lay allegedly stole all that money and defrauded people in his capacity as CEO of Enron. Who was going to go to jail? Ken Lay individually. That's a distinction without a difference. Because if that fine had not been paid, Mr. Telchik would have been brought in. Mr. Telchik, if he ever wishes to be the treasurer of another PAC, has a cease and desist order that has been entered against him. That is a stain upon him. And if there's ever a violation, they completely ignore the duty, the requirement under 2 U.S.C. Section 434A1 that Telchik as treasurer was required to sign and file each report. Each report. It's undisputed. Barbara Bonfiglio signed those returns as treasurer. That appears to violate 18 U.S.C. 1001. As an agent to the treasurer, and it's not its, which would be the office, it's his or her, that's the individuals. That's to whom you owe the duty. That's the person to whom you are the agent. So, but for the entry of the conciliation agreement, we wouldn't be here. The prior murders don't give rise to a cause of action because no damage flowed from it. The request to enter into evidence the designation of counsel from the prior two MERS was for the purpose, one, of showing there was an attorney-client relationship, to the fact that the signature was forged, because it was undisputed on this record that somebody filed those returns bearing Mr. Telchik's electronic signature without his permission. That's a forgery. And if they were wrong, who gets hailed into court? Mr. Telchik. How do you ignore all these duties? There is a case that's not out of the D.C. Circuit that I'm intimately familiar with that goes to the judicial privilege. It happens to be Brott versus West, 892 Southwest 2nd at 56. Petition denied. In the context of litigation, I was libeled. It doesn't lie against my adversaries. That is not the purpose of the judicial privilege. And the case that the district court relied upon is Jorgensen. It's a Massachusetts case. And it clearly holds that if it's a case of extraordinary negligence, the reputation damages may be recovered. That is, defamation is not the only basis to recover. They were negligent in filing these returns that they signed off on that were bad. They have violations of federal law and violations that carry felony penalties. They could have avoided all this. All they had to do is substitute in Ms. Bonfiglio as a respondent, name her as treasurer, and let her take the responsibility. But they didn't even do that. And as to a state of mind requirement, I don't think it should be required, because whether they're an agent or whether they're an attorney, they owe the same duty. It's uberima fides, the utmost fidelity and loyalty to disclose everything. If they had just told Mr. Telchik, you have been sued, he'd have been there. And this conciliation agreement wouldn't have been entered, not against him. We don't dispute the findings are right. We just dispute that it was laid at Mr. Telchik's feet and should not have been. Does the court have any other questions?
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the honor.